your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We're going to have in this first hour, we're going to divide this first hour into three different areas. The first, I'm going to talk about two major events and movements and happenings that occurred during the 20th century that had a great impact on America. The impact of these movements and these happenings and so forth would subtract away to some degree the early teachings and the early foundations and concepts that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence would establish. There's a group, especially out of the Ivy League, and Harvard seemed to come to mind the most. And there's a group up there, or a number of writers over the years, that have acquiesced and given in to cultural change being the highlight, and their opinion is that the Constitution should reflect this cultural change. I'm of the opinion, and I'm a strict constructionist, from the viewpoint, I believe the Constitution shouldn't be monkeyed with and distorted and trying to manipulate it into fitting the going fads and cultural trends of the current decades or current century. The founding fathers had a very major impact on how to create a government with a minimum dominance by central government. The idea was based upon natural law and natural rights. Today, in our school system, you won't hear anything about the teachings of natural law and natural rights. In opposition to that is positive law, or statute law, which are man creations. An example of a natural law would be the right to keep and bear arms, which is based upon the right to self-defense. And you could say that no government gives you that innate right. You're born into the world and you have it, and you acquire that right on a natural basis. So you could define that as a natural right. Upon the Second Amendment, Bill of Rights, that right to keep and bear arms is very, very important. We are in the throes of a transformation of America that is unprecedented in scope. And we're in dangerous waters. We have had a change and a transformation that two major movements have impacted and caused that transformation to accelerate. Early on in the 20th century, you had an industrial might that was building up, and Chicago seemed to be a center of meatpacking. You had Upton Sinclair that wrote a book entitled The Jungle. He exposed the conditions in the U.S. meatpacking industry, and he called it a public uproar that contributed months later to the passing of the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act and the Meat Inspection Act. The man was a genius in writing, and he was working for the poor man, the working man. And the rise of the labor unions was a result of abuses that were visited on the working man by big industry, these big companies. So I can understand that, and they went out to protect their workers. But along with this, you had a political formation occur, a formulation, you could say, of groups that wanted to band together and were on the socialist, communist, progressive side of the political spectrum. On the other side, you had the capitalists that were being attacked by these collective groups. But the problem with their attack was this. In 1913, the Federal Reserve was created and established. And that Federal Reserve system today is owned by private interest. So the monopoly of money creation thus began to come under the control and dominance of private interest, not government. So this Federal Reserve has grown to become a monstrosity of power and dominance that many today would say are favoring the Federal Reserve is nurturing and funding and giving has given rise to a crony capitalistic system. Now, what do we mean by crony capitalism? It's monopolistic capitalism. Crony capitalism is the Federal Reserve acting on its own behalf of creating credit from out of thin air. Now, several years ago, friends of mine, we were meeting on Monday night here in Austin, and they were talking about credit, you know, money being created out of thin air. I didn't quite like what I'd heard. So I went home and came back the next night or the next meeting, which is the next Monday. And I said, I have an answer for you. And they said, what is that answer? And I said, money is not created from out of thin air. It's created from out of the space-time continuum, meaning that the modern banking system, which goes back to Babylonian banking and much later, after that, the Italians got into the act and started creating a much more modern sense of banking that spread throughout Europe and into the Netherlands, and eventually the UK established the Bank of England. And we later in 1913 would establish the Federal Reserve. So basically, it's the right of banks that are check-writing banks to establish on their books from out of thin air certain credits that can be drawn upon by check writing. And so that's what they meant by that. But when I came back with my answer and I told them, I said, it's not out of thin air, it's out of the space-time continuum. What I meant was that we exist in a field system of electromagnetic radiation surrounding us. Of course, there's air there also. But in this field system, we can begin to create ideas, and these ideas are streamed to one another. They're bouncing around. Sometimes you could say a television set is an emanator then of ideas and information. And then we're walking around and the light's reflecting our own, you know, image, and that's reflected to other people. So this is the way that we begin to get conditioned and programmed into a way that's a worldly system and a way of worldly thinking. So these bankers eventually realized that they could create a monopoly of money creation on their sets of books, and then that would give them the dominance over all business. And that's basically what they've done in this field system. So the idea is a stream of light that is gives rise to a system of thinking, and the public doesn't know any better. So early on, we had the collective. The collectives, let's say, and that would, include your communist, socialist, progressive types that favored the labor side. So the labor side began to be in combat and conflict with the crony capitalists. But they didn't differentiate that who they were fighting was crony capitalists, not real capitalists that were fair-minded capitalists. So that's the problem. We've got to start awakening this collective left. Today, I would say the Democratic left would be right there in the center of these debates and thinking that. The collective left did not support Ron Paul and is in the Fed or even the audit the Fed. In fact, Sanders voted against Ron Paul's bill and helped kill it in Congress about the audit of the Fed. So, see, he's not really for the people either at times. See what I mean? Because the big money is still powerful in this country. And the center of banking worldwide and financial power is the city of London. That 1.1 mile square in downtown, square miles in downtown London, is the focus of most of the financial money power in the world. So you had these collectives organizing together, the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, the Progressives, and so forth. And they began to be actually helpful to the protection of workers' rights in the form of unions organizing. And they began to organize in Detroit in those automotive producing centers. And that's okay. I mean, collective bargaining and all that's all right. So that was throughout, that gave rise also to many people wanting to go into government, and the Communist Party and all these others says, go in, get government jobs, become a spy. You know, don't tell anyone you're a member of the Communist Party or anything else. See, later, Joe McCarthy would discover this, that there were a lot of Trotskyites. Now, the reason why there were Trotskyites in our government was early in the 20th century, 1917, Leon Trotsky was actually in New York City, and he was put on a freighter, on a ship bound for Russia, to get together with Lenin and Stalin and foment revolution in Russia. The Germans were at war with the Russians, so they were behind some of the financing of this, of both Lenin and Trotsky. So Leon Trotsky is on a ship. He's detained by the Canadians, who get clearance eventually from London and from Washington, D.C. Now, what kind of passport did Leon Trotsky have? He got a passport issued to him that was an American passport by Woodrow Wilson's government. Now, who was the little, you could say, advisor off to the side of Woodrow Wilson was House, Edward Mandel House, that comes out of the Houston area. He wrote a book entitled Philip Drew Administrator that was about socialism and communism in a collective state and a dominant type of government. So, but also, Edward Mandel House would not only help create the Federal Reserve System, being a banker, his father was a banker in Houston, but also he would establish the Council on Foreign Relations in 1922. So he's a very powerful individual, and he was from Texas. So that's to give you a little background as to Woodrow Wilson giving that passport to Leon Trotsky that went to Russia to foment revolution. So the money people, Anthony Sutton wrote a book about this, about the Bolshevik Revolution being financed by Wall Street. And it was by Wall Street and London and the Europeans. Other banking interests were behind the Bolshevik Revolution. How does that work out in today's plan, you could say? Is that in today's plan, in the modern sense of transforming America, they want to transform America into a collective communist state with the people vying for benefits and entitlement programs and looking to government to secure Social Security and so forth and all these other benefits. We're a long way toward that goal right now anyway. And then the top level resembles much more of a financial fascist capstone, you could say, which is appropriate in this class, being a pyramidal type of power organization. So that's the way it lays out right now as far as I'm seeing it from the collective side. This collectivist movement would start infiltrating the federal government, and later on, Joe McCarthy would become aware that there were these Trotskyites in our government who eventually would become, we believe, neocons. So Joe McCarthy became aware of this and started making these pronouncements. And C.D. Jackson was an interesting individual. After World War II, Eisenhower took office as president. And C.D. Jackson began to be his international advisor. C.D. Jackson, before the war, had worked for the Time Look, the loose organization. And then during the war, he was a psychological warfare officer in the Army. And then he came back and began to be an international advisor to Dwight Eisenhower's administration. Now, C.D. Jackson was a very interesting individual in the sense that later on, it would be admitted that he was CIA agent. But during this period in the White House, he started attacking Joe McCarthy. And he led the charge against discrediting Joe McCarthy. Now, you ask me why? I'll tell you why. Because Joe McCarthy was uncovering a network of Soviet spies at the time that were being controlled by Russia, but had acquiescence, had actually secret authority from the internationalists, which would manifest in such groups like the Illuminati. So these people were controlling networks within our country to bring about a socialist communist state, but Joe McCarthy was adamantly against that, so he was in conflict. But C.D. Jackson, working in the White House, was actually trying to scuttle and trying to torpedo Joe McCarthy to keep these secret communist agents in our government hidden. And I'll tell you why. C.D. Jackson later would lead the American contingency to the Bilderberg Group in the Netherlands and at the Bilderberg Hotel. That's where the group gets its name. It was that first meeting was financed by the CIA in 1954. So we're talking about internationalists here working to transform America into something other than what its original intent was. And now we're seeing a series of presidents come along that are setting off alarm bells to me in a very, very big way. We had the JFK assassination in 1963, November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas. But it looks like to me, and from my studies, the same people that control that assassination are the same people that are in power today. But they're pulling bigger things like 9/11. They're going in and attacking the Branch Davidians. They're going in and have a hand in the Oklahoma bombing, which is proving to be other than McVeigh alone did it with his buddy. You know, he had backing. McVeigh was working a black ops operation. Look into it. A Noble Lie is an excellent documentary on this. But anyway, so America is being used and transformed into something different. At the end of World War II, there was a project that's become public now called Project Paperclip. And Project Paperclip was a project to bring Nazis into America post-World War II. And the way it worked was that if you had someone, an immigrant, coming in to be cleared through the immigration system, and they had a paper clip on their papers, you ushered them right in. No questions. Don't question them. Now, who they were bringing in were Nazis. And this story gets so convoluted and involved and a little bit complicated at times. Let's go back to what happened at the end of World War I. We need a little history here. The Versailles Treaty imposed upon Germany some very, very large sanctions and penalties. It put Germany into a state of economic, problems. It created economic problems in Germany to meet those obligations that were imposed on them because of the Treaty of Versailles. The mechanism set up to start collecting the money was the International Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland, in Basel. So the Germans would pay the money to Bank of International Settlements, and they would distribute it in turn to the Allies who supposedly won World War I, right? Well, the Bank of International Settlements worked both ways. They not only collected money from the Germans, but there was a conduit. It was a conduit for building Germany back up again, its industrial might, okay, before World War II. See? And that's really what happened, was that your Western financiers started building Germany back up again after World War I, and actually they were financing what they called the Weimar Republic, preceded, you could say, Hitler's, government. So Hitler's government was after and subsequent to the Weimar Republic. And I'll explain that in just a second. The Weimar Republic was a constitutional republic formed after World War I. Hitler's Nazi party began to have a greater influence and a greater membership in the parliament. And eventually, there were two acts that occurred that gave Hitler power, that brought Hitler to power. And he was able to scuttle the constitution that existed under the Weimar Republic. And those two things were the burning of the Reichstag. Now, is 9/11 a similar thing? Let's think about that. But anyway, Hitler planned that, and his Nazis carried out the burning of the Reichstag, which was the meeting place for their parliament building. And I've been outside there and looking at that parliament when it was in ruins in 1965 in West Berlin. I was looking across the wall there. So I've seen that in ruins. Of course, they've rebuilt it now, and it is again, Berlin is again the national capital of Germany. The East Germany and West Germany were put back together again and consolidated, even though East Germany had a lot of problems and it took a lot of money to rebuild East Germany. So Hitler also, he issued the Reichstag decree, and they blamed this on the communists that were a rival party to the Nazis during that early Weimar Republic period. And then also, this gave rise to a later Enabling Act that was passed, and the Enabling Act took away the constitutional rights of your average German, and then that enabled the government to come in and search without warrant or anything like that, or any reason, any German citizen's home and so forth. And so that's what gave him, and then later on, the government, it gave in, and his Nazi power grew until he was able to dominate the government totally. And after the Enabling Act, he took it totally into a dictatorship. Is America being transformed by 9/11 into something that we had never wished to happen or even anticipated? In my opinion, yes. Today, after 9/11, there's all kinds of home security acts and this and the Patriot Acts and all this, and everything has taken away our freedoms and liberties. And they've created these fusion centers, and they've indoctrinated the police and the army into thinking that the patriots of this country are the problem and the enemy. Hell, the patriots in this country want to bring about a reestablishment of America again. Not this 9/11, post 9/11 national, you could say, security state that has developed. And that's exactly what we're looking at now in this country, is that the 9/11 was used in a way to convince the people, the public at large, that we needed to do a stricter, more harsh security crackdown and enforcement, and especially of these crazy domestic terrorists, see, that they're starting to label as anyone. And what's dangerous is this, is that anyone that is against the government, anyone that's against global warming or environmental things, or anyone like that, or similar types of issues, is a terrorist, because they're creating fear and everything in the society. We have on the college level microaggressions and statements, that have to be made by professors before they trigger statements and things like that, before they address their class sometimes. That is just, it's just getting crazy, But getting back to what's going on now is that, yes, there has been a transformation of America. And I'm laying out some of the big trends and some of the influences that have impacted us and have been changing us. Okay? After World War II, this Operation Paperclip, what happened was Martin Bormann, who was the gatekeeper for Hitler, okay, in the Chancellery in Berlin, and no one got to see Hitler except going through him. So Martin Bormann was very powerful. At the end of war, he escaped out of Berlin and was able to get on a freighter and make it to Argentina, and he continued to operate in Buenos Aires in Argentina. Before the war was ended, though, Martin Bormann transferred billions of dollars through the Bank of International Settlements. That's this bank that was created in 1929, I believe it was. And was able to transfer large sums of money through the Bank of International Settlements to Buenos Aires, to Argentina, and other countries for the Nazis to have money to live on after World War II. In the meantime, they had what they call rat lines that were set up by the Catholic Church to help Nazis get out of post-Nazi Germany after the end of World War II. So the church itself helped creating these rat lines to help Nazis get out. And this is proven fact. I've mentioned earlier on about this paperclip thing, which enabled Nazis to enter this country. There were many that were welcomed, like Wernher von Braun, so that he could start developing our space industry through NASA and so forth. But also, there were many former Nazis that were ushered in and given jobs in academic jobs in psychology and so forth. So our intelligence operatives wanted to, and MK Ultra is a result of that. They wanted to pioneer in mind control and mind washing of the American public. And they used these former Nazis that were in some of the death camps and Holocaust camps to do research for years. So that was a very, very bad influence for America. Early on, we had this communist, leftist, socialist, progressive thing that influenced America early on in the 20th century. And then midway through the 20th century, we had these Nazis coming in, see, and doing their thing on America. So neither one, see, has been positive for the country. And so where do we stand today? Where do we go from today? Today, starting in 1963, we had the JFK assassination. Shortly after that, we had Robert Kennedy. We had Martin Luther King killed, okay? And so these were major, and then Malcolm X also was on the list, it looks like. There were four main assassinations. First, JFK, RFK, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. And these were all done to eliminate adversaries that the insider, the real inside group that came together on the JFK thing, they wanted eliminated certain individuals that were a danger to their network. Now, that network in this country and in the world is still alive and well. You'd have to say that the network that's dominant has to relate back to the Bilderberg Group. I was in Copenhagen in 2014, and I got to see firsthand what that Bilderberg Group was about. But I've studied it for this subject for about 30 years, and I've also interviewed Daniel Esterlin, who's written a book on the Bilderberg Group, and also transhumanism and other subjects like that. So when you look at this 30 years, you begin to know the system at large, and it's not getting any better. So along comes Trump, okay? Trump is an outsider. Every major power player and mover and shaker is against Trump. So that says to me that everyone that is against him is part of the network. And that's very true to a large extent. And that network is getting more and more powerful every day. The mistakes, though, made by this network have been one of the biggest mistakes that I see today. And Brzezinski just recently regurgitated his policies that he was advocating about getting up there and getting in the face of Russia. Recently, he's made some other comments that said that those policies have been wrong and we need to change our policies. That was just recently in the last few weeks. Okay? Check it out. Go research it. Put Brzezinski in there. The Grand Chessboard is his book. Okay? So, they begin to understand that these policies about Russia have been wrong. And they've actually, because Russia has been attacked and so forth by the Germans and twice, and they are paranoid. And you get up there close to Russia, and you're going to run into problems. And that's what these insiders and these elitists and globalists are trying to push us into a war with Russia. Now, it gets so complicated now that I only have about 20 minutes more to go tonight, so I have to be careful on my time to cover this subject properly. The players now, it's getting real dangerous. The biggest mistake that the globalists made was in the derivative market. They've lost billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions. They've never reconciled those books yet. The 2008 was not an economic crisis. It was a financial crisis in the financial sector. And today, they have not figured out. If you go and you start looking at the World Economic Forum meetings, this last one in January, and then you look at this Bilderberg meeting, the bankers have not been able to figure it out. They've taken the interest rates down to zero, nearly zero, to stimulate the economy for cheap money, and it hasn't done it. We're in a deflationary cycle, and they don't know what to do. They're talking about helicopter drops now of money into the public sector to get some spending going on. So we're in a dire strait. The financials don't even know what to do. The bankers are grasping for straws. And so that's where we're standing now. Now, getting back to this transformation, it's ongoing all the time. While there were books written called Culture Wars a number of years ago, also there's something called Cultural Marxism. And Cultural Marxism was a concept that the collective left has blamed upon the paleoconservatives like Pat Buchanan and other people like that, you know. But because we had such a large number of people in the early 1900s, in our universities and colleges, into the 50s and 60s, they were teaching, they became crypto Marxists. They were teaching Marxism and collectivism versus against this big enemy called capitalism. But what they were really fighting was crony capitalism, but they were not saying that. They were just using the term capitalism in a very general way. I've also said many times that the little dressmaker in downtown San Antonio that's making dresses and selling dresses and with their own money, that's capitalism. It's this, these concerns have gotten so big and horrendously large where we're getting into a more monopolistic operation of these large corporations, and then they're working together. Now, that's the real danger about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. You have all these people that are for that. Are you kidding me? They're just pawns of the corporate structure, and they're not going to do us any good. These are major problems that we've got to confront, and we have to try to overcome, and we haven't done it yet. And we've got to continue on. But then you have this election that pops up, and you have it's unprecedented. We have Trump, whose ego problem is just so big, you know, he hadn't overcome it yet. And then we've got Hillary in there, and then she's committed all of these heinous federal crimes, and they won't do anything about it. I mean, the country is just whacked out, you know. It's the rule of law. What is that? They don't even go by that anymore, you know? Who it go by the rule of money. Who has the money, you know, wins. And a friend of mine used to say, the biggest rat wins. The biggest rat with money wins, basically. That's what we're coming down to. We're coming down to a very, very harsh and aggressive and mean-spirited economic system and political system that's based totally on money and nothing else. I don't know how this election is going to work out. What I see there is that I see that the Democrats are going to cheat at the polls on behalf of Hillary. But also I believe that they'll be joined in by those Republicans that are against Trump. So you're going to, not only are the Democrats going to be cheating at the polls, you're going to have the Republicans come in and help the Democrats cheat at the polls. This is going to be an unprecedented cheating at the polls against Trump that I see. It's going to be difficult for him to win. He's having, just recently, earlier today, he spoke at a black church, had a standing ovation up in Michigan. And my gosh, you know, the black churches are standing up now. They're beginning. Maybe he's awakening them, see. He's been starting to reach out to them. On the other hand, we have Hillary that is in decline that I see. I see her very ill. She's a very ill person. And I wish her the best of luck in trying to cope with her medical problems. But I don't think she has the will or the physical health and strength to make it through this election cycle. But anyway, we have her out there continuing to hammer away. Trump went down to Mexico and looked like he was presidential and statesmanlike, you know. And so that boded well for him and gave him a bit of a lift. The polls, whether they're honest or not now, are beginning to show Trump pulling slightly ahead of Hillary in most cases. They work these crooked polls at times, who knows. But for her to win this, it looks like they're going to have to try to keep the polls as close to as they can to make it look like it's a close race, and then cheat him in the end with the Democrats and Republicans joining in together. And it would be the Republicans that have been derogatory and discrediting him all along who will be at those polls helping the Democrats. This is what I fear the most. If we have an overwhelming turnout for Trump, and I think we have a lot of closet Trump voters out there that aren't going to talk about it because they're being harassed too much by some of these Hillary supporters. So I believe that what's going to happen there is that you're going to have a lot of people that go in there and they're going to say Trump, you know, and they're not going to tell people they voted for Trump. They say, oh, yeah, I voted for Hillary or something, you know, just, well, I decided not to vote or something. They'll make some excuse to put it off or to not talk about it. And that basically bodes well for Trump. I met with a friend of mine today, and he's really astute in politics and so forth. And we've talked a lot of these issues today, and I want to thank him a lot. I won't mention his name, but he's really a very stand-up guy. And first name is Richard. I want to thank him for our little meeting today. And he has really tremendous insight. And he's a guy you can count on, I'll tell you that. Richard stands for something. And today in this world where people don't stand for much, he does stand for something. So thank you, Richard, for meeting with me today and giving me some ideas and stuff. But getting back to the program is that the middle part here, I wanted to talk a little bit about the self, okay? And what I want to say about that is that this thing called the self, it's a reflection, see, of who we think we are, see? And when you're talking about trying to come out of, and I always call it the delusion, see? In other words, the way I look at it, and I put together what I call the new school a number of years ago. And what I did in that new school was I began to talk about self-knowledge, see? and self-knowledge has always been a most noble goal of humankind, and that we're both self-conscious and self-regarding, and we need to establish the possibility that we have the capability to know ourselves. See, and but knowing thyself is difficult to achieve more than you could imagine. It's an age-old problem. See. And have we ever achieved it, see? Have the masses ever achieved it, see? So, know thyself is an old saying that came out of the Temple of Delphi. Even before that, Socrates taught it. It was etched in the outside the temple door there of Delphi, Apollo, a temple of Apollo, see? Delphi was an occult center, see, of ancient Greece. And so they not only had Olympic Games on the plains of Olympus, but every 2 years later they would have Olympic Games there in Delphi. Some would maintain that the modern Olympic Games today are reiteration of the Pythian Games that were held at Delphi. And that was the name of them at the time, the Pythian Games. But anyway, so know thy thoughts. I first started out with know thyself, see? And you've got to try to awaken yourself to the way you really are. And then I added two more things. And I added know thy thoughts, okay? That means to be able to observe those thoughts as they're streaming through your mind. And if you can really start doing that, you'll begin to see that those thoughts are very judgmental of others, and they're very much a put down of others at times. While we try to buoyant up our own ego self, see. And then the third thing that I set out there was know thy world, and that means that it has two levels. One level would be on the interpersonal relationships with others, where you're beginning to understand human nature, the weaknesses of your own human nature and someone else's human nature, but not judging and forgiving yourself and others for that human nature problem that we all exhibit. See, the solutions, okay, that I'm setting out for trying to reestablish and bring us back from this transformation of America, see, is that we need to get back to a natural bill of rights based on and generated by natural law, natural rights. We need a financial bill of rights where everyone worldwide would have access to community banks on a fair and equitable basis, see. And what I mean by a community bank, it would resemble somewhat a credit union bank, okay? And that's more honest banking. Coming out of it could is one of my solutions. And coming out of it would be a means by which to come out of the delusion, the programming. We find ourselves in a predisposed system of thinking that we've been indoctrinated into. We're born into the world and our parents are right there. So who do we begin to be programmed and indoctrinated and their ideas are induced into us by? It's our parents. And then our siblings, our brothers and sisters and so forth, they have an effect. We begin the first grade, the schools have an effect, what they teach. We go to church, that has an effect. So we're predisposed to a system of thinking which collectively together begins to form a worldview. Now that worldview may be a pagan, dark, sinister worldview, or it might be a very Christian view. Or it might be some new world, new age view that would be what they term today as a cosmic humanist view. So that's that. All of these people today, all these different parents, are bringing up their children with a lot of different ideas. So, three things that I came up with also as solutions, and these three things come together as one package. Forgive all always. Forgiveness releases all from a synergistic system of hate-fueled megalomaniacal creatures who manifest demagoguery of rulership, establishing and nurturing a man-created rebellion against goodness. That's what we've got to forgive, those people in a high level there that are nurturing a rebellion against goodness. Usury not. Minimize your interest paying, thereby reducing economic slavery to those who unrightfully have gained control of the unnatural mechanism of money creation. And the third one is depossess all. Expunge all mind and brainwashing ideas of propaganda that govern our actions and beliefs, and exorcise them from all structured evil exorcism. So those are three things that I've been talking about for a number of years, and trying to get people to awaken to. And I've written some things called "Be Good to Yourself and Others." That's a little saying I've had. And the delusion. When I talk about the delusion, what I mean there is that we're deluded into this predisposed system of thinking. Our parents, unknowingly and unwittingly, have been conditioned and programmed by worldly things themselves. So they, in turn, induce into us and predispose us to a worldly system of thinking. But usually that worldly system of thinking is not on the forgiveness side. It's other than that. So we've got to try to recover. You know, it's like an alcoholic has to try to recover, you know, in recovery mode. You know what I mean? Got to stop drinking, you know, run around with people that are of the same ilk, and try to, you know, quit that drinking, you know. And we're of the same, we're in the same dilemma, you could say, is that we have to stop thinking these predisposed ideas and start forgiving ourselves and others. And thus, in that system of forgiving self and others, you'll begin to dissolve what I have termed in the past the false self, say. I believe that what is being cultivated in this whole dynamic, after we begin to be, you know, indoctrinated with ideas and stuff, is the false self. And that false self then cries out and yearns to live, and so it struggles, and it's rebellious against any goodness or anything that is detrimental to its survival or threatening to its survival. So that's what the problem of the false self is. So we don't know that. We're thinking the false self is our real self, but we're in a delusional state, so we don't really see that. The delusion that we have come to be embedded in tricks us into continuing that state of delusion, and the delusion itself hides the deluded state, or the delusion hides the delusion. So that's basically the way I see it coming down in that way. The forgiving way is the path to truth, for when forgiveness being exists, truth is. And forgiveness is the way. I set out in the new school these kinds of teachings, see. And the new school would basically teach why we are schooled to begin with. And the reason why we are schooled to begin with started in Prussia, where they were schooling people on a nationwide basis so they could become good Prussian citizens and fight for the country. Now, what were they fighting for? They were fighting for the wealthy that wanted to keep and continue their hold on the wealth of the nation. So that's basically the Prussian model or the German model. And all they did was that was bring it over here. The early schools in America were religious schools, and finally we're into this public education now. This public education now with the core teachings or whatever. I mean, the example, just go and look at how they're teaching how to add and subtract and all this math. It's gobbledygook. It doesn't make sense. And because it doesn't make sense, it's confusing. Our children can't give you change in a fast food operation off of the top of the head. They have to punch it into this machine called a cash register. And then they just look at that and they just give it back to you like a little parrot, you know. They're uneducated. It used to be the trivium and the quatrivium that were the standards, okay, upon which most education was based, okay. But what happened to that? Are you kidding me? They threw that out the window. We can't have that, you know. We got to teach them this modern schooling. We need to, the trivium was a system that combined three things, okay? It combined grammar, logic, and rhetoric, okay? And then later on, that would, later in education, and what that was about was, it was a system where you could begin to derive factual certainty from information perceived with the traditional five senses. So you could use sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell, okay, and using this system of education, try to come up with the truth somehow, okay? And the quadrivium is what was subsequent to that, and that added arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And I mean, there was an education going on here, folks. Today, they can't even add out there. The kids can't even read. You know, there are people that take a clipboard and go in front of these universities, university campuses, and ask some of the students, who is Joe Biden? They'll say, well, I don't know. And then you say, you can ask them another way. Who is the Vice President of the United States? Oh. But they can tell you about football. They can tell you about the movies. They can tell you about the music. They can tell you about the games. Oh, they're into computer games. Oh, they'll spend a fortune on those things. But they can't tell you. There's no civic interest. And that's where they've come up with the idea that the self itself is changed, okay? And that self, okay, is not responding in the same way that it used to. There used to be a patriot self that was patriotic to the country, but to the legitimate things that the country stood for, the natural law, the Declaration, and the freedom and liberty. It used to be that we were patriots, but that's what we studied. Now we're not studying any of that. So the self is infatuated with, embroiled into, conditioned into, seduced into a world of fantasy. See, it's all make believe. See, you go and you get this computer program, and then you can become someone by being the top scorer, you know, of that game. Well, I scored 2,000. The guy says, well, I've got 2,100 on that, you know. But there, it's like Shakespeare said once in one of his plays, Macbeth, I think it was. It says the sound and the fury, and but nothing of valid of significance resulted. You know what I mean? Something like that. That's a paraphrasing that. But we've got a lot of sound and fury, see, in all these movies and in these games, but there's nothing of significance coming out of that, see. In other words, I've got 2,000 points, or I've got a score of 2,000. What do you have? Oh, I didn't do but 1,500, you know. I mean, who cares about that? But we've conditioned a society into microaggressions and all of this trigger statements and all this stuff that is overemphasized. And people care about one another. But when you try to force them into acting through intimidation and through this political correctness, you're going to get people back up on this stuff. They're not going to just, you know, roll over, you know, and say, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, one other thing is that I watched recently an Aaron Burnett Out Front program, and they were discussing on that program. I think she's pretty well educated. Her background is like Goldman Sachs, financial analyst. And then I believe later on she got into television and production and finally made it to this program on CNN called Out Front. Erin Burnett, she's married to a banker, works for Citibank as a managing director, I think, of high yield. But anyway, I happened to be watching her program after Trump, you know, went down to Mexico and came back. And she had panelists, guest panelists on there, and they were talking about whether or not he was presidential or statesmanlike or whether or not it helped him or anything like that. And I noticed that she kept bringing up this thing about a lie. You know, in other words, she was trying to say that the statements he made afterward, there was a statement by the but Nieto, Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, and then the presidential candidate Donald Trump spoke. And then she would, and then there were questions asked of him about the wall. And so there were always, she was trying to force the conversation into talking about the wall that, that Donald Trump wanted built and stuff like that. So, and so, but what made me very wary of her interviews was she kept bringing up the word lie, you know. she wanted to say, in essence, that Trump was lying about some of his statements that he made subsequent to his visit in Mexico City, in Los Pinos, with President Nieto. So, and she kept bringing that word up and trying to inject that into and getting a response from her panel guests, you know, that were on the program. And you know what happened? I didn't see one of them respond to her. And she said that word five or six times trying to inject it. And because she's totally... Oh, also, she's a Council on Foreign Relations member, which is has a lock on foreign relations, period. So she not only worked for Goldman Sachs earlier, but she worked her way up in the banking business for Citibank, Goldman Sachs, and also she's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, which has a monopoly on our foreign relations. And so then she's gotten into this broadcast. Now, What I see there was someone very biased on Hillary Clinton's side, totally obvious, and trying to inject into the conversation this thing about lie, you know, which, you know, this is power politics, and all those big mainline, you know, broadcasters, they have people on these programs like that. She's not fair that I could see. I haven't seen her program much. But I would say that she's not very fair in her reporting or her program. But definitely on Hillary's side, just trying to push the Hillary thing, you know. But anyway, I want to thank each and every one of you out there for listening. This is George Butler, thesecrettruth.com. We've been broadcasting on November 1st of this year. It will be 10 years. We hope to have some other things lined up next week on post-traumatic stress. Disorder. We have a man from Vietnam that we're lining up now to give us some good advice on that. Who he and his wife established a fund for warriors to mend them and to help. And it's not that group that, you know, took off with the money. This is a reputable warrior foundation group out there that they created. But anyway, we hope to have him this coming week. I keep hammering away about the dangers that we're in, and we are. We are in dangers. Some of my friend, I talked to a friend today, and he's wary and fearful of some kind of a major event happening. See, that could result in a problem, in the country. So anyway, I want to thank each and every one of you out there for listening tonight. I'm going to repeat last week's program on hour two, where I went in there and defended some of the criticism that Hillary had of Alex Jones. And I believe Alex Jones is doing a fine job, and I stand behind him 110%. Okay, thank you for listening. Good night.